first general session of the Fall 2013 Convention of the California Council of the Blind. Yes. And I know, I know that person over there. Welcome, everyone. And what we are going to do is we're going to start off this session doing a $25 cash door prize. You know, board members can't get money, right? Isn't that a conflict of interest kind of a thing? Yeah, that's true. John is running. Let's have Charlene, and let's do the $25 from San Gabriel Valley chapter, CCB. Is Ken Metz in the room? Oh, all right, Ken. Now, do we have a second volunteer in the room? Okay. So what I'd like, I'm directing traffic here. If we could have the second volunteer up here as well. Or is the second volunteer guiding people? Okay. Do we have a third volunteer in here? Good. So we can have someone, so that we can have someone helping folks to get seated. So Ed, you will pick the names. And our volunteer will take the door prizes to folks so we can be nice and efficient here. Shall we have another door prize? Yes. All right. We're going to do a chill mat. Yeah, a chill mat can be used for a doggy, for a person, for however you want to chill. And go ahead and pick the winning ticket. Let's see who gets the chill mat. Is Judy Wilkinson in the room? Judy Wilkinson is not in the room. Pick another name. Lynn Coates. Lynn Coates, are you in the room? Yay, Lynn! All right. Great. If you can raise your hand. All right, it is on the way. Let's do another door prize. All right. Okay, the next one, let's do a more money. Is that what you said? Why don't we do, we'll do the money, but not yet. Not yet. Is that Albert? Albert is always famous for winning our 50-50. And I try to say, Albert, don't you need to go outside? We're going to do the drawing right now. And he never listens. I don't know. We're going to do the plastic doggy bone, doggy bag dispenser. And this one is, I think it's green or is it blue? It's the green one. And this little doggy bone can clip onto your doggy's harness, on the collar, on the leash. They're very cute. We're selling them at the CCB table. We're selling the chill mats at the CCB table, too, in the exhibit hall. So come visit us. David Hanlon, are you in the room? Nope. Next. Let's see. Joni Patchy! Yay! Great! All right, shall we do another door prize? How many is that? That's too many, isn't it? No? Okay. Why don't we do a Trader Joe's gift card? Oh! Our volunteer said, I might put this in my own pocket. Steve Berkman, are you in the room? Not in the room, though. Oh, he is in the room. All right. Charlene said, you owe me. Oh. All right. Why don't we do a bag of fudge as our next door prize. Yum, yum, yum. Sounds like a plan. Let's see. Rob Turner, please raise your hand for your wonderful bag of fudge. We're going to do one more bag of fudge. How about it? Yeah. Let's do it. And the winner is
Sam Doherty.
Sam Doherty, are you in the room? Sam Doherty. Nope. Draw another name. Let's see.
Lena Dawes.
Lena Dawes, are you in the room? Not yet. She's probably out with charity. That's her guide dog. Brian McCullen, are you in the room? Brian. Nope. Nope, nope. I'll eat your fudge for you. Nope.
Jerry Amundsen.
Jerry Amundsen, are you in the room? Jerry, all right. We have... All right, folks, guess what? We're going to end this round of door prizes with a $25 cash prize from the San Gabriel Valley chapter. All right, let's see who gets it. Margaret Buckman Garcia, are you in the room? All right. Thank you, everybody. Tell all your friends it's good to be on time to the general sessions. When I'm up here, I love to give away door prizes. All right, everyone. Everybody's sharing fudge, sharing cash. How do you guys like the classroom setup in here with the tables? Yes. Good, good. I thought they'll either love me or hate me. We'll see. There's no in between. All right, good, good. That's good to hear. All right, we're going to go ahead and bring our session to order. Thank you very much again for being here. We have with us for our invocation the Reverend Darren, and I said it earlier too, the right way, Erisman.
Oh, that's excellent. Thank you.
From Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Encinitas, California, to do Encinitas, California, to do our invocation. So if we can have quiet, please. Thank you.
It's a privilege to be here. Oh, just got to get my mic. There we go. My name is Darren Ayers. I am a Lutheran pastor just up the road, and so happy to be here with you. It is wonderful to gather in this kind of thing. I'm besides a pastor, I'm also working on a PhD in Christian-Muslim relationship, and I work a lot in interfaith work. So I meet a lot of folks from the area, and I'm excited to meet you today. And it's a blessing to come together, I think. Whenever I'm at a conference, there are people that I haven't been with for maybe some months or even a year or two, and it is a blessing to reform those relationships and to make new ones. And there's always opportunities, and so grateful that we come together as a community. There's something gifted about being with people who really understand the work that we do and the special calling that is particularly ours. So as a community together, let us gather in prayer this afternoon, acknowledging those relationships that bind us together and that lift us up by a higher power that holds us all. So in that spirit, let us take a moment of silence before a word of prayer. We come to you from different places and beliefs. We come to you with challenges that require endurance and patience. We come to you with dreams that demand hope and action. Gather this community in your loving presence, that they may be strengthened in their relationships today and may work with conviction tomorrow. Fill them with your Spirit, that they may be renewed with clarity and compassion. And all bless the work of these good people, their families, and all the people whose lives they touch. In your name we pray. Amen.
Thank you. Okay. We will have Charlene Ornelas, someone from our wonderful San Diego here, lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
If you can, please stand. The flag is in your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And I heard play ball. I don't think the Dodgers have started yet. I don't think... Ah, everybody knows who's here who wasn't at the board meeting last night. It's good. They have them in the back of the room. Good, good, good. You put yourself there. Okay. He must have a earpiece in his ear or something. I don't know. All right. Next on our... Oops. Okay. There we go. Better. Roger says you're still on the assisted listening device. Okay. Pursuing... It's okay. I didn't say anything wrong. Pursuing employment, independence, and equality for all blind and visually impaired Californians. Today we have with us from the Department of California Department of Rehabilitation, Elena Gomez, Assistant Deputy Director, Specialized Services Division. Please give her a warm welcome for being here today.
If you want to hear me, is it on? Yes, wonderful. Okay. I've never had that much luck with microphones. I just wanted to say how honored I am to be here today. This is my second time attending a CCB convention. The first one was Sacramento, and today, San Diego, and with the classroom set up, no less. Thank you, Donna. Okay, before I begin, I just kind of want to take the opportunity to acknowledge and thank President Donna Pomeranz and the CCB leadership for our continued partnership in advancing employment and independence for blind and visually impaired Californians. And also for having us here to be part of the program, to share some information about the Department of Rehabilitation, and also to have an opportunity to hear from you as well. We're going to have some time at the end of the presentation from some questions and answers. Now, Director Tony Sauer and Deputy Director Joe Xavier cannot be here today. However, they extend their very best wishes for a most successful convention, and they also wanted to express their true appreciation for the work of CCB. And I also want to take this opportunity to acknowledge and thank any members of the DOR staff that may be in the audience for all the work that you do each and every single day. Thank you. Okay. Now, the purpose of the presentation is to kind of give you an overview of what's happening on the national, state, and departmental level. And really, the intent is for us to be transparent with the community to ensure that the community is kept informed and that you are positioned to provide, you know, effective and meaningful advice. So So the first thing I kind of wanted to talk about was happening on the federal or national level. I was going to start off by talking about the federal shutdown, but as of yesterday, that's over, right? Yay. But I know a number of questions came up. Well, what does this mean for the Department of Rehabilitation? Were you able to provide services? And the answer is yes, in spite of the federal shutdown, and we will continue to provide services. One thing that's happening in Congress right now, for those of you who may not be aware, is the reauthorization of the Workforce Investment Act, and the Rehab Act is incorporated in that in WIA. And within that particular legislation, the reauthorization, they're proposing to move Rehabilitation Services Administration, RSA, which is the federal oversight for all of the state VR programs, proposing to move it from Office of Education over to Department of Labor. And Independent Living as well, that includes the older individuals who are blind program, they're looking to move that over to Health and Human Services. And there's a concern right now within the disability community that it may mean that there's a trend to moving away from individualized vocational rehabilitation programs to more of a generic job placement assistance programs like the one-stop centers. So we're keeping a very close eye on that particular legislation, and we're informing our agency and our governor any potential impacts to the Department of Rehabilitation and the consumers that we serve and the disability community at large. So it's a very important piece of legislation. So we will certainly keep the CCB informed if there are any significant developments. Another thing that's happening is the Affordable Care Act, and I think most of you know it as Obamacare. And within California, it's called Covered California. And right now, they just launched an education and outreach effort to enroll millions of Californians in the new health insurance options that are available. So if you have any questions about what's available right now, I would encourage you to check the website, Covered California. And we're going to be giving some information to our rehabilitation counselors out of the field so they're able to share this information with their consumers. Next item I kind of wanted to bring to your attention is federal hiring. And back in 2010, President Obama issued an executive order to all departmental agencies to increase the employment of persons with disabilities. So that is a mandate, a charge that he's given to all departmental agencies. Additionally, there's new regulations that are in the process of being passed, and we expect them to be effective this coming March. And basically, the regulations will require that all federal contractors and their subcontractors need to have at least 7% of their workforce be people with disabilities. So I would encourage all of you to consider hiring, you know, to apply for federal employment, because now is really the time, and a lot of the agencies are being, you know, charged with the task to do more outreach to our population. But last, but not certainly not least, on the federal level, I'm really truly pleased to report that Janet LeBrec, who's the former commissioner for Massachusetts Blind, has been appointed as the new RSA commissioner effective August 1st. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but out of the four commissioners, three have been, out of the four past commissioners, three have been blind or visually impaired. So that is great progress for the community. So I'm very pleased to, you know, share that with you. Okay, so now I kind of want to touch on what's happening within the Department of Rehabilitation, and I can share with you that it's been full of activities in the past year. We've been working on some major initiatives in the Department of Rehab. The first is we've been celebrating all year long our 50th anniversary. We were established back on October 1st, 1963. So we just finished our celebration earlier this week. We are proud of our accomplishments over the last 50 years, but we know there's still so much more to do in California, which kind of leads me to the next thing that I wanted to share with you, which is the DOR strategic plan. And this is something that we haven't really quite done before, but we worked with the community, with our partners, stakeholders, consumers, CCB, other, advocacy organizations to develop a five-year plan about what we want to do, from 2013 to 2018. And as a result of the input we received, we came up with a vision for the department, which is kind of an abbreviated version of our mission statement. The vision is employment, independence, and equality for all Californians with disabilities. And within the strategic plan, we have three major goals. The first, which is obviously most important to us, is employment, independence, and equality. And basically, that means maximizing employment opportunities, independence, and increasing self-sufficiency, resulting in a higher quality of life for Californians with disabilities. In a nutshell, getting more competitive outcomes for our consumers. Our second goal is equal access, to promote equal access for Californians with disabilities. And essentially what that means, kind of we're asking ourselves to provide more educational resources to improve access to businesses, information, technology, transportation, and housing, to improve the integration of individuals with disabilities within their living and working communities. And the last goal within our strategic plan is customer-focused services to our consumers, partners, employers, and employees. So for that particular goal, we're kind of taking a look at recruiting a qualified workforce, taking a look at our processes, what we could do to improve, to increase consumer satisfaction. So, I would encourage you, if you would like to have more information about a strategic plan as well as state plan, which is something that we're required to submit annually to receive funding from RSA, I would encourage all of you to visit our website at www.dor.ca.gov. I'm going to repeat it because I see some of you writing this down, okay? www.dor.ca.gov. Okay. So another major initiative that we've been working on, I think many probably heard a term, just VR mod, and it's actually Vocation Rehabilitation Modernization Initiative. And within that initiative, we have three major projects. The first one, because a lot of our counselors, as well as consumers, had concerns that that the council was spending too much time working with an antiquated computer system doing case management and not spending enough one-on-one time with, quality time with their consumers. So we basically replaced that antiquated case management system with the new system called AWARE, and that's being used in about 25 other states as we speak. So it's much more user-friendly, and it's much more effective at processing casework. However, we're still making some refinements to really enhance the functionality of that particular software. The other thing that we've been working on within that VR modernization initiative is taking a look at how we provide services to consumers. Again, the consumers wanted to have more, one-on-one time with the counselors. The counselors saying, even with the new computer system, we still have to do a lot of case management, case documentation, and that's taking time away from my consumers. So what we did is take a look, maybe we need to change how we deliver service to the consumers. We took a look at what the counselors are required to do. You know, there are five functions that only they can do. However, some of the other functions, such as following up with the consumers, making sure they got their transportation check, making sure they got the check for books and supplies, interview closings, calling them up to make sure the assistive technology is working, those are functions that could be done by other staff, therefore freeing up the counselors to spend more counseling time with the consumers. So we've added, for each consumer, they're going to be supported by a team of three individuals. That's the counselor, the rehabilitation counselor, but they're also going to be supported by a service coordinator who's providing case management support to the counselor, and an office technician who is also available to provide support. So if the counselor's out of the office, the consumer can certainly reach out to the service coordinator or the office technician. It gives services and support without any delay. So we're very excited about that. We spend a lot, you know, over the last several months hiring staff to create that team model to support our consumers. And most of the teams are in place right now, including Blind Field Services. And we also added another position to support our consumers, and they're called employment coordinator positions. So they're there to provide additional support in addition to the services that we get from our community rehab programs that provide job development and placement services. But the employment coordinators are there to help with resumes, interviewing skills, labor market research. So they're just an added resource. And again, the idea is to be able to provide services without delay. So we're very, very excited by this model. You know, it's going to be fully implemented by the end of this year. We're going to be going full, you know, speed next year, and we fully expect to see increased level of consumer satisfaction and more employment outcomes in the coming years. Third project under the VR modernization initiative is called the Vendor Utilization Management Project. And really, it's taking a look at two areas: services to consumers and invoices, payments to vendors. The service to consumers, we're taking a look at to see how we could better support our community rehabilitation program, our providers, to provide services that will lead to employment outcomes for consumers. And that means taking a look at our fee structure and performance expectations for the providers. And in terms of invoices, a lot of our providers have, you know, approached us to say, you know what, it's taking too long to get paid, you know. And, you know, we represent a large, you know, percentage of their business. It's very hard for them to continue providing quality services on a month-to-month basis, and their payments are being, you know, rendered timely. So we're taking a look at to see how we could streamline that process in order to support our providers so they, in turn, can support our consumers. Okay. So we expect a lot of changes to come out of this particular vendor utilization management project next year. Another initiative that just came to us, we were just told by the federal government that we were awarded a federal grant, the PROMISE grant, which stands for Promoting Readiness of Minors in Supplemental Security Income. And that is a federal grant that will be $10 million per year for 5 years for a total of $50 million. And the focus will be on providing services to children ages 14 and 17 who receive SSI, as well as their families. And the goal of the grant is to improve education and employment outcomes for these children, but also to help support the families to become less reliant on the SSI than their children may be receiving, and to empower the children to go out and get some work experience, you know, get training, you know, and not delay that process until they turn 18, but, you know, start earlier rather than later. Because we all know that transition to employment needs to start earlier. We can't wait till they're 17 or 18. It needs to start when they're 13 or 14. We need to get them into that mode of thinking about what they want to do in the future and what they need to do in order to become prepared and employed. So some of the services that will be provided under the Promise Grant is going to include case management, benefits counseling, career and work experiences, and parent training and information. But we're not doing this alone because this is a major, major project. We have partners that includes the Employment Development Department, the California Department of Education, Department of Social Services, Developmental Disability Services, and school districts across the state to help make this project a success. Okay. And the last item I wanted to touch within, you know, in terms of what's happening with the Department of Rehab overall, is I don't know if you're aware, but there's been some changes to the Client Assistance Program, CAP. In the past, we would receive the funding from RSA, and then we would award agencies to provide CAP services. And for those of you who may not be aware, CAP services are there to assist DOR consumers who may not be satisfied with the services they're receiving or the direction that their case is going. So they would go to CAP, and CAP would advocate on their behalf. But it was kind of always, the dynamics was always kind of strange because we get the money, we pay the providers to support our consumers who may have issues with us. So effective October 1st, that's no longer the case. RSA now gives them funding directly to Disability Rights California. They are the CAP provider. Okay, so we're no longer involved in the process. So that kind of takes away that perception of the conflict of interest, some perception that people have some concerns about. Okay. Now, I kind of wanted to touch about a subject that is very near and dear to my heart. I really want to remind everyone that we really, really want to see more individuals with disabilities in state service. We need more of you, more, more, more of you. And the only way that you could be considered for state employment is if you take the examination, pass the examination, get on the list, submit an application, and be ready to do the job. And I say this because we've done a number of outreach for some of the positions that we have, and we're not seeing applications come in. For example, we had the older individuals who are blind manager position open. So we did, you know, some recruitment through CCB and other, you know, advocacy organizations. And can you tell me how many applications I received for a person who's blind or visually impaired outside of state service? How many applications did I receive? Okay, close. Just one. One? All right. Not good enough. But because of the civil, you know, service system, unless we receive an application, there's nothing that we can do. So you have to apply if you're interested in state employment. So apply, apply, apply. So I just kind of wanted to share with you some of the exams that are open. They're online that you could take at any time, you know, of the day or evening, whatever, you know, works best with your schedule. And these examinations are the Staff Services Analyst, the Associate Governmental Program Analyst, the Qualified Rehabilitation Professional, that's the counselor position, Staff Services Manager 1 and 2. It really is online. We've tested them for accessibility. And all it does is ask you questions about your education and experience. So it's not an actual exam where they're testing your writing skills, your math skills, your knowledge of U.S. history, or what have you. It's just ask questions about your education experience. Do you have 5 years of experience in this area? Yes or no? Do you have 10 years? Yes or no? Very straightforward. So I would encourage you to take a look and apply for those exams. And there's also a special examination and hiring process for federal and state jobs. For the federal, it's Schedule A. And for state jobs, there's some, you know, classifications where there's examinations specifically designed for individuals with disabilities. They're called limited examination and appointment program examinations. And again, they're online. So I would encourage you to check our website and look for the employment tab page. Okay, click on that and it will give you information. Okay, and before I kind of go on to Specialized Services Division updates, I'm going to go over the budget. I think this was something that CCB had requested, but it's a little dry, but I'll just kind of recite some numbers here. So bear with me. Oh, and we just have Peter Dawson, our Blindfield Services District Administrator, walk in. Come on over here, Peter. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
Okay, so in terms of the DOR budget, our total budget right now is $413.3 million. And if you were to break that down, the general fund portion is $56.5 million. That's what we get from the state of California. And that draws down the federal match, which is $345.7 million. And then we have other supplemental funds of $11 million, which includes some of the reimbursement that we get from Social Security, Vending Stamp Fund, and the Traumatic Brain Injury Fund. The total number of positions that we currently have is 1,823. And out of that, 1,731 are permanent positions. And the remaining 92 are just temporary help positions. We used to have more positions, but due to budget cutbacks, you know, it's just kind of been whittling away. But I think for the last 2 years, we pretty much maintained the same level of positions. Consumer case services budget right now totals $181.4 million. No change from last year. And I know some folks had questions about the federal sequestration, what's happening with that. And the most recent estimate that we have from RSA, it does not include any kind of sequestration reduction for federal fiscal year 2013-2014 for all of our federal grants, including the older individuals who are blind grant. So what does this budget mean in a nutshell? Basically, it's business back to normal. We're serving all categories, and there are no more furloughs for staff. So we're working 40 hours a week, right, Peter?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Minimum.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So now I would like to kind of give you an overview of what's happening within the Specialized Services Division. And I think most of you are aware that it covers five programs. We provide leadership to five programs. That includes the Business Enterprise Program, Blindfield Services, Orientation Center for the Blind, Older Individuals Who Are Blind, at Deaf or Hard of Hearing Services section. And all of the program managers, program administrators report directly to the Specialized Services Deputy Director, Joe Xavier. And as a result of the legislation that was passed in 2002, which established the Specialized Services Division, we're required to submit a report to the legislature every 2 years on division activities and the number of employment outcomes for blind and visually impaired consumers. We just submitted our fifth report to the legislature, and it's also posted on our website. So I would encourage all of you, if you have, you know, some time, to take a look at that report. There's a lot of good information in there. Okay. So I'm kind of wanting to go on, talk about the Business Enterprise Program. Yes. Yes, Joni is very excited. All right, to hear about it.
If I might, we want to give at least 20 minutes for the town hall portion of the program. And if we don't use up the 20 minutes, then we definitely would also wish to welcome any other comments that you wish to share. So I'm just letting you know if we could have 20 minutes.
Okay. All right. And how much time do I currently have by now?
Okay, currently.
I think we started a bit late.
Actually, I started you right on time. we have, you will be able to go until 2:40.
Okay, so I have 2:15 right now. And I think we'll be concluding our part of the presentation about 5 minutes and then open it up for questions and answers. Okay. The business enterprise program, just wanted to mention that last January, RSA did an on-site monitoring of the BEP, and we're waiting to receive the report, but we were advised verbally that there were no findings, just recommendations and observations, so certainly when we get the report, we will share that information with the BEP vendors and the community. And in terms of what's happening in BEP, we're looking to implement a new software system. It's called BEP Aware, and it's going to help us become more efficient and help us consolidate all of the information into one repository. And in terms of training, the BEP training, we're taking a look at some web-based trainings so we can reduce the amount of time that the students would have to be at Sacramento. It's currently a 6 months. We want to reduce it to 4 months. So hopefully that would encourage more consumers to be interested in applying to the business enterprise program. So blind field services, I'm going to just turn over to Peter Dawson. If you want to kind of give a brief overview of what's happening within your section.
Okay. I might rely on you for the number, so. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm glad I could make a cameo appearance here. I believe I was invited, although I didn't know it. And the only person I could email was Ed, because he's the only person I could think of, and I blamed him for, Ed, I don't know if you're here. Yeah. So I realized I was on the agenda. I was in Sacramento yesterday, though, when I was supposed to be on the agenda. And by the way, I was having lunch with Tony Sauer yesterday. He wanted to make sure. Someone must have invited him. He said he's sorry he couldn't be here, but to give you his greetings. So greetings from Tony and the rest of the people up in Sacramento. And Elena probably has the numbers in front of her, which I don't have, and I know you want to save time for the town hall meeting, but I don't know if you touched on the VR mod, Elena, or anything briefly. You know, she probably told you we're getting all of our teams pretty much, they're almost all complete right now, which has been quite hectic over the last year, but energizing and a good thing. And we got all these new employment coordinators and service coordinators. I look at our organizational chart right now, and I got to admit, I don't even recognize a lot of these names. And it's a lot of changes, but it's also exciting. And you know, a lot of people ask us why can't we have more QRPs and all that. And I don't know if Elena touched on this or not. If we could, we would. It's not that we're not trying to have new positions if we couldn't have them, but we're limited because of our budget, of course. What's that? Okay. I'm about kissing it, but I'll try harder. So, you know, we would have more positions for counselors if we could, but we don't have the allocation and the money for it. So obviously at some point in the future, we would like to have that. So, but for now, getting these teams in place, it's been interesting, challenging, but good. They're almost all fully put together, almost. And I think Elena might have mentioned we're in the process of hiring the operations manager position. And then once we have that position filled, we'll almost be complete. So that's it for VRMod. I don't want to take too much time because of the town hall 20 minutes that you want. But I'm here. I don't have a set script. I wanted to be here just to back up Elena and answer any questions that you might have for me. And thank you for inviting me, even though I didn't realize it. And so, Elena, anything else you want me to touch on or the rest of the crowd want me to touch on before we open it up to the town hall portion? Okay, I'll turn it back over to Elena.
Okay. I just kind of wanted to touch on two other programs, and then we'll open up for town hall. Q&A. Can you hear me?
Better.
Yeah. Can you? Hello?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Okay. All righty. Okay. I just kind of wanted to touch on the other two programs that we have within the division. That's the Orientation Center for the Blind. And right now, we serve a little over 50 consumers a year, and we're obviously doing more outreach to increase that number. And as a result of some R funding that we received a few years ago, we really renovated the campus. We now have an office, a computer training area with state-of-the-art AT equipment. We've converted four of our dorm rooms into studio apartments to enable the students to practice independent living skills before they exit the program. We've also established internships on campus for the students to give them some work experience and to practice their skills. We're taking a look at revising the curriculum to make it more focused on employment. And lastly, we did a recruitment for the OCP Trust Fund Committee, and we're going to be making decisions on appointments to that committee. And, of course, that will be done in conjunction with CCB, in consultation with CCB. Okay, Older Individuals Who Are Blind program. We submitted our annual OIB report to RSA. Again, it's posted on the website, so I encourage you to read it. There's a lot of good information. And I also want to thank any of the partners that are in this room that have contributed money to draw down the federal match. We couldn't do it without your support. We've also hired a new program manager, Chris Gith, to lead the OIB program. He replaced Jay Harris, who's blind, who accepted a promotion earlier this year to the independent living chief position within the Department of Rehabilitation. And right now, within the OIB program, we're kind of taking a look at our funding model with our OIB partners. The goal is to establish a funding model that will maximize services available within provided within available funding to equitably distribute funds that may go unused by individual agencies or any increases in federal funds received, and to readily adjust funding allocations to allow DOR to fund agencies proposing to provide services in unserved areas. So we hope to have a new RFP based on the new funding model. Until then, all of the existing grants have been extended 1 year to allow for the finalization of the new funding model, and we're continuing to have a dialogue with the OIB partners on this project. Last but not least, the Blind Advisory Committee. I kind of wanted to acknowledge the back for their time to provide expert advice to the Department of Rehabilitation on service provision to blind and visually impaired individuals. And Donna Pomerantz and Jeff Tom are the CCB representatives on the committee, but we also have other members here in the audience who also serve on the back, I'm sure. I can't see who. Oh, Margie, I see your hand. Okay, Margie Donovan. So, we would like to thank them for all that they do. And if you have any recommendations, suggestions for how we can improve services, I encourage you to reach out to Donna, Jeff, Margie. They are your conduit to the Department of Rehabilitation. So thank you. So now we're going to open up for Q&A.
Yes.
Okay, anyone who has any questions, please stand where you're at, and we'll get a microphone over to you. Okay, hold on 1 second. The mic isn't on. Not yet. We just need to, and I know we all can hear you in this room, but
that's all right.
There we go. We need to have you on mic for the streaming. Good.
Good afternoon, Peter and Elena. And Peter, I've got, I guess, a question and an interrelated comment. I was privileged last year, I think it was last year, time flies, to have sat on the interview panel that hired you. And normally I prefer asking this question to Joe because he's much more fun to pick on. But as part of the briefing for that interview last year, I believe that Joe indicated that the goal for the department's hiring was something like or placement of 800 blind and visually impaired persons, which, having done three previous stints on the Blind Advisory Committee, I thought was an outrageous number, outrageously high, that is. So my question for you, or my two questions for you, one, do we know what that reality turned out to be in terms of placements? And my second question is that we used to have a document when I sat on the BAC that it was the one report that I looked forward to reading, and I think we got it on a semi-annual basis. And that was a listing of every blind and visually impaired placement in the state. Names were not given, of course, but there were categories of positions and approximate salaries. And that allowed those of us sitting on the BAC to really know whether all of the time and the effort and the human resources and the fiscal resources that the department was putting into finding jobs for blind folks, whether that was being successful. And so I guess I'm asking, you know, do we have the placement figures? And is that document available? And does the BAC membership get it? And if they don't, they should.
That's a very good question, and it's kind of interesting that you brought that up, because I actually provided that report in the last BAC meeting,
yes.
And I think Donna is nodding her head, yes.
Yes.
And I was interested in looking at the report myself, because one of the things I wanted to make sure that there was a wide variety of occupations that our consumers are being placed, and it turns out that is actually the case. I just wanted to make sure that they weren't being pigeonholed to certain occupations, because we know there's a lot of people with talents, experience, expertise in many different areas. So if you're asking for statistics, I could give you, you know, I can't give you the exact numbers, but I'm just kind of rounding it off. Right now, the 800 and 1,000, what Joe was referring to was what can we do to achieve 800 competitive employment outcomes and $1,000 a week. That's the challenge that he's posed to his staff. As people ask Joe, what did you come up with 800? So I just took it out of thin air. It sounded good, 800 at 1,000. It's a goal, okay? But right now, personally, in terms of our competitive employment outcomes, I would say for last state fiscal year, we were around 370. Total outcomes, because that includes homemaker cases, with homemaker cases, it was about 800 and something. So you're looking at a 70-30% ratio there, 70% homemakers and 30% competitive employment outcomes. To me, that's not good enough. It needs to be better. And one of the challenges that we actually posed to the BFS staff and their SB 105 training is to start, you know, taking a look at employment when a consumer first walk in the door. Homemaker is certainly a goal, and for a number of our consumers, it may be appropriate. But for consumers who don't know what they want to do, if they became newly blind, or if they, you know, just don't believe they can work, or the family members don't believe they can work, it's our job. We know they can work. It's our job to empower them with that belief and start talking about employment the first day they walk in the door. So that is the challenge that we threw out to our BFS staff. And we're kind of taking a look, and maybe we need to change how we do business. There were some suggestions about maybe just having one counselor focus on homemaker cases within a unit, and all other counselors focus on working with consumers who are looking to achieve employment. So that's one of the things that we're looking at. We also have a number of employment coordinators that we've added to Blind Field Services. So we're going to be leveraging them to support our consumers to seek employment, be better prepared for employment. So does that answer your question, Mitchell? Did I get your name right?
There we go. that sounds more realistic. But the other point, as a follow-up to your commenting about Homemaker, we are, and part of it has to do with the proposed legislation. But I think there's a real possibility nationally over the next several years. We've already begun to see RSA really devalue or de-emphasize Homemaker placements. And while I understand that vocational rehabilitation's primary goal is to find jobs for folks, I think there's a real possibility in the next 5 years the department will not provide programs and services and assistance to older blind people who have worked their 20, 30, 40 years and simply want to learn to be independent blind people.
Any other questions?
Yes. This is Charles Navarrete. In the LA Times earlier this week, there's a story about the Long Beach courthouse closing and a new courthouse being opened. And as a result of the building management not being just state, but being a state-private partnership, the vendor who had operated the cafeteria at the former courthouse for 20 years was not allowed to transfer to the new courthouse, and the new building managers contracted the food services with private firms, Subway and so forth. My question is, did DOR have the authority, either legislative or regulatory, to prevent that from happening? And if you did, why didn't you do that?
That's a very good question. We typically are not, allowed to pursue legislation. We will rely on our partners, the stakeholders, to do that because, essentially we report to the governor. The situation that you brought up was a very unique situation. It was a legislation that was passed specifically in that area. And I'm not, and I have to be honest, I'm not 100% familiar with it, but I do know that the vendor has transitioned to a different location and is currently working there. Is that you?
Yeah, but it resulted in one less vending opportunity for the blind vendors. Mm-hmm. And if this continues, mm-hmm. that type of situation happens in the future, a private-state partnership will be losing opportunities for blind vendors.
Yeah. I agree, and if you know of any other legislation that's following a similar trend, we would appreciate hearing about that because we could certainly step in and kind of work behind the scenes to ensure that those who are in a position to make decisions are aware of the impact that would have on the Business Enterprises Program vendors.
Thank you.
This is Christy Crespin.
Christy, Peter, one second. Can I just want to respond to something Mitch said earlier, and I'll get right back to you, sorry. Mitch, on your question, I also just wanted to point out, maybe Joe pulled the 800 out of the air. I don't know, but yeah, I think he did. But the number is more realistic. But I think there was obviously a dip for everybody during the recession and during the poor economy. But I do want to point out that I saw a report recently where 26s in the state as a whole over this last year were up over 1,000 from where they were last year, which was, I think, a big surprise to a lot of people. And out of all the districts, I think Blind Field Services had one of the top three percentage increases in amounts of 26s over the prior year. I also, the RSA standards and indicators that came out also indicated that we had the 50% higher than the statewide average in the hourly rate per hour for the placements. So we're doing a better job. I know we need to do better still,
And obviously we're going to work towards that goal. I don't know if we can ever get to 800, be nice, but I just wanted to add a little bit to that, and that's all.
And I just wanted to add to Peter's comments that in terms of the hourly wage earned by blind and visually impaired consumers who achieve a competitive employment outcome, it's about $19 an hour. And when you compare that with the rest of the department, the average is about $11. So we are looking at a higher wage for our blind and visually impaired consumers. And in terms of the percentage, 70-30, it used to be lower before we had specialized services division. But even then, you know, there's still more that we need to do. More progress needs to be made.
Christy?
Okay. I do want to comment on Charles's comment or question. Department of State Hospitals, which used to be Department of Mental Health, and most likely Department California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, are also not using BEP at all. And every time I see us go through a new vendor, I just get so irritated, and I don't know why that hasn't been pursued. My question, again, is about counseling and therapy services. I really truly believe and will continue to advocate that clinical social workers be placed at the OCB and other living, independent living facilities, you know, because part of being able to live independently is gaining the skills and gaining the ability to advocate for oneself. And I would really strongly urge consideration for you to have social workers at these facilities.
Okay. Thank you. I'm just actually writing that down. And it was kind of interesting that you brought that up because we were having a discussion at OCB whether or not we need to have an occupational therapist on staff. But you brought up another interesting point. So, I did make note of that because we're having more individuals with disabilities coming to OCB that, in addition to blindness, they have other issues. And those issues need to be equally addressed. You know, sometimes blindness, you know, may not be the most significant barrier. It's the other issues. So we do recognize that, and your suggestion is well taken. So I will make note of that. Thank you for sharing. Appreciate it.
Christy, I just wanted to add on the BEP question I think you mentioned. That was part of the question, right?
Yeah.
I was at the 50th anniversary event the other day at Department of Rehab up in Sacramento, where they brought in all types of people. There was a very interesting BEP vendor who spoke. I don't know, Jeff, if you're here, you'll know what I'm talking about. But, I learned in that thing, when that guy came on board, it was an 82-year-old vendor. He's still working, apparently. And he got his first facility, I think, in 1963, but I think there were 320 stands when he came on board, and now they're 110, and BEP is going through a lot of changes, and they're trying to make things a lot better, and he confirmed that himself. But I keep hearing that they are lacking, you know, good qualified people to fill, you know, the stands or the positions that are potentially out there. So I'm not a BEP expert by any means, but I'm just telling you what I'm hearing. And I don't know if you know qualified people, but it is a great opportunity. This is, you know, one of the key things. I'd love to see it go better. And just like at my facility, Christy, in Mission Valley, I mean, there's an open space there for a vendor to work right there. That building has 1,000 people, and I don't understand why there isn't one there. And so, but I keep hearing that we don't have people to put into these positions. So obviously, if you know people that can go into this program and make a go of it, it's great. Despite what that, you know, some of the failures that man mentioned, there's also been some great successes, including people I heard who are making up to $44,000 a month in that program. So, you know, so there's a widespread and a lot of potential for people who have the drive and ability, but I think they're having a hard time finding the right people to get into that program. So I just want to make you aware of that, and if you know, and if you disagree with that, that's fine, or agree. I just wanted to let you know what I'm hearing up in Sacramento on that.
This will be our final question. Any hands or stand? Anyone stand? Nope.
We're that bad.
Margie.
Hi, this is Margaret Buckman Garcia from Merced. I would just like to, something you talked about with the Promise program. I work with the Center for the Blind and Low Vision in Merced, and I represent our organization in a local transition council at the school district level. And the reason I keep showing up at their meetings is everything with workability and all those programs that they have that are for high school kids and that level to try to get the disabled recognized by employers excludes blind and visually impaired kids. So I'd just like to make, I don't know what you can do and who's going to be on these committees and that, but I think something needs to be brought out that that program needs to include other disabilities than just the cognitively disabled, because that's where the focus seems to be on those programs.
Yeah. Come and see me after we're done with the town hall meeting, so give me the specifics, okay? And then we'll take a look into it.
Okay, would you wish to give any closing comments to our group?
I'll leave Elena the last word, but I just want to say I'm surprised you guys don't have any more questions. This is a very talkative group. I know that. It must be the after lunch effect. Anyway. I encourage you all, you know, to feel free to either through the back or otherwise to even contact me with concerns. I don't want to think that you have to go through a hierarchy. So we want to address your issues and concerns. I wanted just you to know that after my first year, which has been kind of a wild year, I want to have more time to address some of these things that I just haven't had time to address and I'd like to address. So I just want you to know I'm open to that. And once again, the BEP thing, I really encourage some of your consumers who might have an interest in it. It's such a great opportunity, I think, is so underutilized. I would strongly encourage you to do that. Along with, by the way, I don't know if you've been talking about federal employment during this week. I'm imagine you did. But my wife, for example, happens to be a recruiter trying to get people into federal work for Spa War in San Diego. They are really actively recruiting Schedule A in particular hires. And even though you hear about hiring freezes and everything else going on, they're still hiring. So just keep that in mind, because those are the kinds of jobs that we want people to get off Social Security and get those benefits and have a nice quality of life with benefits. So last comments, and thank you for having me, and invite me early next time. Okay. Aww. Thanks.
Peter took the words out of my mouth, and he's a tough act to follow, too. So, again, I would just encourage you that if you have any questions or concerns, recommendations, or suggestions, you know, to reach out to the CCB representatives who are on the back. They are your conduit. And, of course, you know, you could contact Peter or myself. You know, we're always willing to accept phone calls, hear your concerns or issues. So lastly, I just kind of wanted to thank CCB for inviting us, the Department of Rehabilitation, to be here with you today. So thank you very much, and I wish you all a wonderful, wonderful convention.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And now we're going to play some musical chairs. Our next... I know. Linda says, I want to hear the song. Don't ask. Our guys are ready back there. You never know what song they'll play. I know. Next item on our agenda is litigation and structured negotiation update. Linda M. Dardarian, partner, Goldstein, Borgen, Dardarian, and Ho, from Oakland, California. Katrina L. Island, associate, Goldstein, Borgen, Dardarian, and Ho, Oakland, California. Kevin Nestrick, senior staff attorney, disability rights advocates, Oakland, California. Join members of CCB's legal team from Goldstein, Borgen, Dardarian, and Ho, and disability rights advocates for the annual update about cases in which CCB is involved through either litigation or structured negotiations to ensure greater independence and inclusion of people with visual impairments. The update will cover access to health care, education, travel, and retail. Hear what the team is currently doing to improve access to websites, information, and services. Oh boy, our favorite. Information and service kiosks. Yes. Other equipment, prescription information, and other alternative formats. Bring your ideas of what they should be doing next. Please give them a warm welcome to our conference and convention.
Thank you, everybody, and thank you, Donna, for the introduction. This is Linda Dardarian. One update on presenters. Katrina couldn't make it today, but instead we have something even better. Mike Nunez from Disability Rights Advocates, and Mike is going to start us off with some very, very exciting news.
Hi, everyone. This is Michael. It's nice to be here. I'm glad I could join you all. So I'd like to update everybody on a case that CCB is involved with regarding access to voting. It's a really important issue. It's long overdue, and we have some really exciting positive news to share. But in case all of you aren't familiar with the case, which is against the County of Alameda, I'm going to give you some background and tell you about how the case came to be and why we're so excited about a recent landmark decision that we received from the court in this case. So about a year ago, shortly after the November 2012 election, we started receiving calls and complaints from blind voters in the County of Alameda about their voting experiences during the November 2012 election. Now, many of you may know that the Help America Vote Act and California state law require that counties and other public entities that are administering elections provide talking voting machines to enable blind voters to privately and independently vote. The County of Alameda had provided these machines at poll sites, at least as far as we've heard, but the complaints were essentially a little different. What we were hearing from voters was that although the machines were physically at the poll sites, that blind voters weren't able to vote because the machines didn't work when they tried to use them. The accessible features, the text-to-speech output and the tactile controls, wouldn't work. And so some of these voters who brought complaints to us reported that, you know, they had spent anywhere from 30 minutes to several hours at poll sites waiting for poll workers to try to troubleshoot problems with the machines, call for assistance, call for replacements, and in three instances, you know, to go to second poll sites, additional poll sites, and try to use the accessible voting machines at those poll sites, only to find that the accessible voting machines there weren't working either. You know, this was a really concerning problem to us, and we had heard about sporadic reports of this sort of thing happening in other counties and locations as well. So we decided to investigate the issue. And after doing some fact investigation at the end of 2012 and in the beginning of 2013, we found that this seemed to be a widespread problem in the county of Alameda, and you know, that it was a serious problem important to the community as well. After, you know, conferring with CCB's leadership as well, we learned that this problem isn't unique to the county. It's a problem that is that folks have experienced in other counties across the state, in Los Angeles and other places in Southern California. So we realized that this is something we really needed to start tackling. We also did some preliminary legal research and found some bad cases that were a little worrisome. So there have been courts in the past that have looked at the right to access voting machines under federal disability laws. Now, many of you may be thinking to yourselves, you know, the Help America Vote Act, HAVA, requires these machines, so it seems pretty clear that, you know, that they need to be there and functional. It's true that HAVA requires these machines, but an unfortunate fact about HAVA is that private individuals can't sue to enforce HAVA. Only the government can enforce HAVA. So, you know, if a county violates HAVA, you might be very upset. I would be very upset, but we can't use that law to try and compel the county to provide voting machines and to get people privately and independently voting. So we had to look to, you know, our stalwart allies, the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act. And courts that had looked at whether these laws require private and independent voting hadn't directly addressed the issue, but had suggested that the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act don't actually require that blind voters get to privately and independently vote. The courts had suggested that just providing a sighted assistant who could basically fill out a ballot for a blind voter was enough. So, you know, we saw these cases and we were a little concerned. But we, you know, we did more powwowing with CCB leadership and our legal team, and we decided, you know what, this is a problem we think needs to get tackled, and we need to correct this bad case law, because in this day and age, with the kind of technology that's available, you know, kiosks, touchscreen tablets, smartphones that are accessible, it's pretty inexcusable that a county, a public entity administering a public election could circumvent or get out of its obligation to make sure that blind voters get to vote privately and independently, just as all other voters in the U.S. get to vote and have been able to vote for over 100 years. So we decided to move forward and try to tackle the problem. We initially approached the county in the early part of this year to request that they, you know, look at the problem, understand the problem, and then take a number of steps to fix the problem. You know, there are several steps that can be taken to make sure that blind voters are able to more reliably, privately and independently vote at poll sites during elections. You know, there's always going to be the occasional situation where machines malfunction, but the county can do a lot to make sure that those situations are at a minimum. So, for instance, improving poll worker training so that poll workers are more familiar with operation of the machines, ensuring that there are replacement accessible voting machines on hand so that way if one machine for whatever reason can't work or we can't get it to start working, they can just, you know, pop open another box and set up a replacement accessible voting machine pretty quickly. Making sure that there is open access to technical support that's very familiar with troubleshooting problems with accessible voting machines. And so there are a number of steps that can be taken to make sure that these problems are at a minimum. So we basically laid this out to the county, and you know, this is probably not a spoiler alert, but we weren't able to reach a settlement agreement at that time. So we decided to move forward and file a federal complaint in federal court. So we ended up filing a case in the Northern District of California, U.S. District Court, on behalf of CCB and five individual voters from the county of Alameda, alleging violations of the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, as well as state laws. So in response to our lawsuit, the county filed what's called a motion to dismiss, which is basically an effort to try to get our case thrown out of court. And they basically said, you know, that they hadn't violated the law because the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act don't require that they do anything to make sure the voting machines work for blind voters. That, you know, the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act only require that they make sure that blind people can vote, even if that means having blind people dictate their votes to sighted strangers who record the ballots for them. But we had expected that this might be something the county would do, since we had, you know, done that preliminary research I mentioned to you. And we did our briefing in this process in September, and we had a very exciting hearing last week on this issue. And the judge opened the hearing by sharing his preliminary thoughts. Now, I will tell you, leading up to the hearing, we spent a lot of time preparing our briefs and our arguments so that we could present our case and your case as strongly as possible. That being said, I think that all of the attorneys on the team felt like this was going to be a tough fight. You know, there are these bad cases out there, and there weren't any other cases out there on the books that said that the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act do actually require that blind voters get to privately and independently vote. So we were trying to get the first one on the books. So, you know, we weren't sure what to expect, but the judge opened the hearing last Friday by sharing his thoughts that basically he completely agreed with us. He completely agreed with CCB's position and our position. I'm glad you guys are happy about that. I am too. We all are too. So he said basically that, you know, the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act requirements, they evolve as the technological capabilities of society evolve. They're not frozen in time. They're not frozen in 1990 when the ADA was passed, or in the 70s when the Rehabilitation Act was passed. So as accommodations and modifications become easier over time, the ADA's requirements broaden, they grow in scope. So in this instance, what he basically said was that in this day and age where accessible voting machines are ubiquitous, they're commonplace, they're readily available, and they're not new, they've been around for a while now, that the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act require that blind voters receive the right to privately and independently vote. So, Yes, we are thrilled about that. And the hearing was also a good experience because, you know, many members of the community were there, including Donna Palmer, CCB's very own president. And the judge was pressing the attorney for the county, the attorney for the defendants, to, you know, clearly state their position, which they had clearly written in their written papers, which was that, you know, the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, they don't require any private and independent voting for blind people. But the defense attorney was clearly squirming there as he was facing down the members of the community who were there and being asked to state that position in front of them. So it was a sight to see and a sight to hear as he squirmed trying to avoid saying what they had clearly stated. But at the end of the day, the judge said that he planned to issue a ruling that said exactly this and that would codify his sort of views that he had delivered orally that day. And on Wednesday, 2 days ago, the judge issued a 23-page ruling where he exhaustively went through and supported his position, which is the first decision in the country to rule that the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act require private and independent voting. He rejected all of those other cases that, you know, we had been worried about and that the defendant had pointed to as being sort of poorly reasoned and out of date. And he rejected the defendant's efforts to get our case thrown out. So now our case is able to continue, and we are optimistic that this very positive ruling will make it easier for us to either A, litigate the case until we hopefully prevail on getting a good fix to the problem of ensuring voting machines are working during elections, or the alternative being getting a good settlement agreement with the county. So we're planning on reaching out to the county and seeing if now that we have this solid ruling behind us, they're going to be more willing than they were 6 months ago to sit down and try to reach a reasonable settlement agreement that'll make sure that there are procedures and policies and backups in place to make sure that people aren't left hanging when there are problems with voting machines in the county. So this is, you know, a great victory for voters in the county of Alameda, but it's also a great decision on a national scale. It turns the tide on a string of several bad rulings that courts have issued over the past 15 years about narrowly interpreting the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act when it comes to voting. And it also is going to make it easier for advocates in other counties and other jurisdictions around the country to try and advocate for improvements in voting accessibility and access to talking voting machines in their counties and in their jurisdictions. So we're really hoping that this case and this decision not only improves access in the county of Alameda, but that it serves as a critical watershed turning point in the fight for ensuring that blind voters get access to this really essential civic experience that, you know, so many sighted voters have been able to enjoy for over a century.
This is Kevin Nestrick, Disability Rights Advocates. Great recap, Mike. I know Mike has been working very hard on this case, as with many others. We got a real vigorous advocate for advocating for CCB's rights and CCB members' rights with Mike, as you can see. I wanted to provide an update on another matter that Disability Rights Advocates is working together with Linda Dardarian's firm on behalf of CCB. This matter is more is in the context of structured negotiations where we represent CCB and a number of individual CCB members in a structured negotiations with Kaiser seeking to improve access for a whole range of services that Kaiser provides for blind and visually impaired members. A little background on this issue. DRA had a settlement agreement with Kaiser, and as part of that settlement agreement, we tackled a lot of physical barrier issues. We also addressed some issues affecting people with people who are blind and visually impaired. But at the end of that settlement, we were still continuing to receive kind of a second wave of complaints about numerous failings in Kaiser's system. So with that information, and really it was the detailed information that a lot of CCB members provided, and also the organization placing its name on this complaint, we submitted over 30 pages of detailed testimony, information, legal argument about the way Kaiser was continuing to fail its obligations. That ultimately led to some back and forth, and ultimately we got into structured negotiations with Kaiser only after threatening to sue and being prepared to sue and file a lawsuit sort of on the eve of that decision. They agreed to enter into negotiations. The road traveled since that time has been long and a tough go. We are making progress. I'm confident we're going to get a significant result, but it's taking significant effort to get there. We're seeking to address the whole range of issues. So just the list includes physical access, path of travel, wayfinding, a whole range of issues related to alternative formats for all kinds of print materials, all kinds of healthcare related information that's provided to Kaiser members. Members are that's what Kaiser calls its patients and people who seek their services. It's only increasing the amount of information that's being communicated back and forth in a variety of ways, both in print and in electronic forms. With the passage of the Affordable Care Act, there's new requirements for the creation of electronic health records and for making that information available, making various healthcare information available electronically, scheduling appointments, emailing your doctor, getting test results, getting lab results. We are seeking to make sure that all that information is accessible in a format that the members we represent can use. And so that means every type of alternative format. So someone who wants Braille can get Braille. Someone who wants it in an audio form can get it in a CD. Someone who wants to get it as an electronic file and read it on their computer can do it that way as well. There are some electronic systems within the hospital network, and when I'm talking about Kaiser, it's 30 hospitals and affiliated facilities throughout Northern and Southern California. There are paging systems in laboratories and in the pharmacies, and the accommodation needs for those places, those important, critical aspects of healthcare, it's really haphazard the way that accessibility is provided. So we're seeking to obtain some kind of uniform system so that you know what to expect when you go into a Kaiser facility. Another issue that remains is the need for staff training and an understanding of how better to serve Kaiser members who are blind or have visual impairments, how to better serve their needs, how to ensure that regular training is provided and mandated so that staff members are aware and also a more responsive system to respond to your individual complaints. rather than calling the general 800 number to try to get some staff members who are more specifically trained in the issues that may affect you, and so they can try to resolve them more quickly. So that's what we're after. We're in the midst of negotiations. We are working, you know, on an agreement as we speak. If you do have if you are a Kaiser member and you do have issues with the way that you, they're providing services to you, we do want to hear from you. It's just more information, the better for us, because from their perspective, they feel like they're doing a good enough job, and it's us dragging them along the way, telling them no, they're not, and it's really with the individual stories that show give the real world life examples that, you know, I think is going to help us get to the result we want. Final aspect of this has to do with talking prescriptions, availability of those. I'm going to turn this over to Linda Dardarian, who's done a lot of work in this area.
Thanks, Kevin. One of the big initiatives that CCB and ACB and AFB as well have been undertaking in the last few years has involved increasing access to prescription information, both the words that appear on the prescription label that's attached to medication bottles and boxes and tubes, and the patient information sheets that the pharmacies provide that go along with the medication, that have more description about what the medication does, what the side effects are, and different information that's important to know how to safely take your medications. So we have been seeking access to both prescription labels and patient information sheets. And the efforts have proceeded on two separate fronts. One front you may all know about is the Access Board's Best Practices Committee, where the ACB, CCB, AFB, and other members of the blindness community, along with industry, so representatives from the major pharmacy chains, met together and came up with a list of best practices this summer, which include things like talking prescriptions, large print labels and prescription information sheets, other audio formats, electronic formats, and Braille. In addition, we have been in structured negotiations, we being my office and Lainey Feingold, on behalf of ACB, CCB, and AFB, with most of the major pharmacy chains in the country to require them to provide alternative formats for pill bottle labels and patient information sheets. And as a result of those negotiations, we have one settlement agreement that has been achieved with Walmart. And Walmart agreed to provide talking prescription information through a method called Script Talk. The way Script Talk works is the company that created Script Talk, Envision America, sends out a digital reader to anyone who calls the 800 number and asks for it, who has a visual impairment, and they send those out for free. What the pharmacy does is the pharmacy has a printer that prints the prescription label information on a special label that has a computer chip embedded in it. And they attach the computer chip label onto the prescription bottle or box or tube. And the patient then receives, or the customer receives, the prescription bottle from Walmart. And you hold the bottle over the reader, and it announces everything that's on the label. It's complete, and it's accurate, and it's through a synthesized voice So the pharmacist does not have to actually read the prescription label into like a tape recorder and attach it to the pill bottle. Instead, the work is all done automatically by the computer printer. So ScriptTuck is available for free to Walmart customers. So if you have a medication plan that is allows you to get your prescriptions from Walmart, you can currently get them for free with the ScriptTuck method. Well, I don't know if the pills are free, but the that depends on your medical plan. Yeah, it depends on the copay. But the ScriptTuck label and the ScriptTuck device are free. So that is available through Walmart mail order and through specified stores around the country. This agreement is set to expire at the end of this year. Before the end of the year, we will be having another negotiation session with Walmart to talk about what their plan is for the future, whether they're going to continue with ScriptTuck, whether they're going to roll it out to additional stores, or if they're going to change to a different method. But Walmart has committed to the need for providing independent access for its customers with visual impairments to the prescription information that is essential to taking your medications safely and independently. We are also currently still in negotiations with Walgreens and CVS about accessible audible prescription information and alternative formats for patient information sheets. And we hope to have something positive to report on both of those before the end of the year. Target is in negotiations with us on accessible prescription information, and Rite Aid has also signed an agreement to negotiate with us over accessible prescription information. The problem with Rite Aid is that we are going back and forth, and they have made a lot of arguments that accessible prescription information through a talking pill bottle for the label information or alternative formats are not necessary because they have pharmacy staff available 24/7 to read information to people over the telephone. So no is the right answer to that argument. We were prepared to file a lawsuit against Rite Aid. We had a plaintiff. The plaintiff was Patricia LaFrance Wolf. Very, very sadly, Patricia has passed away for many reasons. We miss her terribly. We are looking for others to step up who are willing to take on Rite Aid. So if you're a customer of Rite Aid for their prescriptions, for medications, prescribed medications, please let me know. I'd like to take a show of hands so that I can see who else is.
Raise your hands if you're.
Makes difference more than Southern California.
Yeah.
Wait.
Sorry, Margie.
Wait.
Okay, Jean.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask, does it make a difference whether it's Northern or Southern California?
That's a great question, Jean. Initially, we were seeking people in the Bay Area, but there is not a lot. Rite Aid is not that ubiquitous in the Bay Area. They have many more stores in the Sacramento area and in Los Angeles. We think that Los Angeles is a better area for the issue because we think the courts are more sympathetic. But if we have to, we'll file it in the Eastern District, which is where Sacramento is, because we think that if what we really would do is we would use the voting decision to springboard into getting a court to rule in favor of the need for independent and safe and private ability to take your medications. So I think now with the voting decision, we could pretty much bring the case anywhere, and we would, our chances would be pretty good.
So what you're stating is
that, okay,
Sorry. What you're stating is that if a person is currently receiving their prescription medication from a Rite Aid, for them to please contact you.
Yes.
That's what you wish.
Yes.
Okay.
That would be great.
Thank you.
There's a hand up in the back.
What
or
I would like
we just take
actually
comments
what,
at the end.
What I would like to ask, Sergeant Sergeant Jonathan Lowe is already here. I have him scheduled to present at 3:20. If we could start that at 3:25. Do you wish to share more about cases, or do you wish to take question and answers?
I think we'll do another few minutes of sharing cases, and then we'll, if we have time for a couple questions and answers, that would be great, too.
Perfect. Thank you.
In the area of access to healthcare information and services, we have a very similar set of negotiations. We actually have a settlement agreement with the Sutter Hospital chain covering all of the same issues that Kevin discussed us having with Kaiser. One of the issues with Kaiser is Kaiser does provide talking pill bottles, but this is also similar to the voting situation. It's one step to get the accessible equipment. It's a second step to make sure that the accessible equipment remains well-maintained and used, and that the people that are providing the equipment know how to make it available to voters or customers or patients with visual impairments. So even though Kaiser has a program for providing talking pill bottles, the staff at the different Kaiser pharmacies don't always know that they have it, so they don't make it available. They don't always record all of the information accurately and completely. And so, I'm sorry?
And you're not able to get it through
And you're not able to get they are supposed to provide it through the mail, but they don't. It's very sporadic. So it should be consistent, and it should be regular, and it's not. So we're working on improving the delivery of complete and accurate talking pill bottles from Kaiser. Kevin, did you want to talk about kiosks?
Sure.
Okay.
So real quickly, one matter that we're looking into in terms of future advocacy is in the area of kiosks, and specifically health kiosks. There is a brand of health kiosk called the Solo Health Machine that has been rolled out nationally to Walmart stores, Sam's Club stores, Safeway stores, Publix supermarkets, a number of CVS locations. And these machines are growing at a rapid rate. They're reporting getting 130,000 visits per day to these machines, that they've served over 32 million unique visitors to these machines. And these are health check-in machines, the whole idea being that a person goes to a Walmart much more frequently than a doctor, and wouldn't it be, it's a good idea to have someone check in on their health, get their blood pressure taken, get a body mass index, have a various types of health screening, get referrals to nearby doctors. This Solo Health kiosk has recently partnered with a Department of Health and Human Services to provide information about the Affordable Care Act and about the various health markets and the marketplace and various aspects of the Affordable Care Act. The kiosks are totally inaccessible. And what we're seeking to challenge the inaccessibility of the kiosks and try to make them independently accessible, much like an ATM would be. So that's an ongoing investigation. I'd encourage you, if you shop at any of those locations, to go visit them, check out, see what it's about. They're located in the pharmacy department, and we're interested in speaking with you if you want to help us change the accessibility of the machines. Mike, did you want could you talk about Redbox quickly?
Sure. So this is Michael again, and I would like to share a bit of information with you about our case against Redbox Automated Retail. So by way of background, Redbox operates a set of touchscreen interactive self-service kiosks. They're video rental kiosks. And essentially what you can do at a kiosk is walk up, browse a library of DVDs, Blu-rays, and other media content that a kiosk has available, and then you can rent, pay for, take home, and then return a DVD or Blu-ray or whatever you rented. And the rates are pretty affordable, which is very appealing. I think when we originally started looking into this matter, it was $1 a day. I think the price is slightly higher now, maybe 20 cents higher, but you know, pretty decent prices. But so getting access to that was an issue brought to us by the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco, as well as several blind individuals in the Bay Area. And you know, in addition to being interested in gaining access and providing access to these kiosks, we had a broader interest in mind as well, which is to get precedent out there that says that these kiosks, which are becoming increasingly more commonplace in all sorts of business environments, that these kiosks need to be accessible to blind and visually impaired customers, because we're seeing more and more businesses use those devices as a method to interact with their customers. We wanted to make sure that the blind and visually impaired community wouldn't get left behind and wouldn't be shut out of this aspect of the marketplace. So when the Lighthouse brought this issue to us in 2011, we started looking into it, and we reached out to Redbox to ask that they basically modify their kiosks to make them accessible in an ATM-style fashion, you know, with controls that would allow blind customers to browse and utilize and access all of the services at the kiosks. This isn't a surprise, but that initial outreach did not lead to an agreement. So in early 2012, we filed a case in federal court against Redbox as well as Save Mart, which is a grocery chain that partners with Redbox and has a lot of Redbox kiosks in its stores. So Redbox and Save Mart initially fought us in litigation for a few months, but after we were able to overcome their initial challenges to our case, we and Redbox agreed to enter into settlement negotiations through mediation. And so we began that process in the summer of 2012. And it's been a very long and slow process, but we have been making a lot of progress in 2013. And I am happy to say that we on the team are really optimistic about our chances of reaching a settlement agreement with Redbox that would provide independent access to all of the services at Redbox kiosks. To blind and visually impaired customers, so that as a blind or visually impaired customer, you could walk up to a Redbox kiosk and without any assistance from somebody else, activate the accessibility features and then navigate through the available media and then select, pay for, and get your movie or if you're a parent or a video gamer, get the game out of the kiosk and then bring it back and go through the return process as well. So I can't share with you the specifics of the technical pieces of the agreement that we're putting together because that's still confidential. But I can tell you that there are two sort of obvious ways of making a touchscreen kiosk like a Redbox kiosk accessible. One is through the sort of ATM style access features that you see and interact with on a regular basis, which are a tactile keypad or some sort of tactile controls that allow you to navigate and interact with the kiosk's content. A headphone jack that would allow you to get audio output in a private manner, and then text-to-speech output that would read all of the controls and the information necessary to use the services on the kiosks. So that's one way. Another way would be through some sort of gesture-based screen reader, like similar to the screen readers that you find on the iPhones or on the TalkBack in the Android operating system for Google devices, or in the newest version of the JAWS screen reader. So those are sort of the two types of access solutions that we look to for guidance when we were when we have been working to reach an agreement with Redbox. And like I said, we're optimistic that we will be able to get to an agreement where the kiosks are kiosks across the state are made accessible for blind and visually impaired customers.
I know we're almost out of time. I'd like to just very quickly mention three other settlements that CCB has been involved in the last year. One, talking about on the subject of movies, due to CCB's efforts and the efforts of many CCB members, all Cinemark theaters, not only in California but across the country, now have audio description equipment. So you can go to any Cinemark theater that has a first-run movie that if the movie comes described from the studio, Cinemark theaters have the equipment to play it. So call your Cinemark theater, find out whether the movie you want to see has audio description, and if it has come with description from the studio, they have the equipment to play it. So hopefully you can all go and have a whole new movie experience thanks to CCB.
Yay.
And another big initiative in the healthcare and information arena is the settlement that ACB and some CCB members have entered into in the last year with Weight Watchers. Weight Watchers has committed to make its website, the website-based tools for weight loss, and its mobile application accessible to people with visual impairments who use screen readers and screen enlargement software. It is also committed to making all of the print materials that it provides at weekly meetings and through the mail accessible in alternative formats, including Braille, audio, and large print. And I think this is the first in the country. The large print standards that Weight Watchers is using are those that were developed by the CCLVI. And then hopefully within the next couple of months, we'll also be able to announce an agreement with WellPoint for making member materials accessible in alternative formats, again using the CCLVI standards for large print, BANA for Braille, and they're making their websites, all of their websites, accessible to people who use screen readers and screen enlargement software, thanks to Steve Mendelson. So, Donna, do we have time for any questions?
We have time. We have time for two questions. And Margie had called for the floor previously, and then I heard Ken Metz.
Ken and Crispy Crespin is up too. Yeah.
Christy's been up.
So, Linda,
hold on.
Hey, Margie. I just have a question for you in reference to the various pharmacies you mentioned.
Yes.
As you know, I get most of my prescriptions mail order, but if I need something such as antibiotics, I get it from a local store. Is that sufficient enough with Rite Aid if I get an occasional prescription from a local store?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll do Ken, and then we'll do Christy, and then that will be it, since Margie was short for a change.
I'll make up for her time.
Oh, no. Okay, we'll cut him off.
Linda, question for you, or hey, maybe a comment. It's in regards to the Walmart issue. I am using the Script Talk, actually, and there are so many advantages to it, only because you can get the side effects. It gives you a phone number to call and a code number, so it's really neat to be able to do that. What happens, however, is, A, as I think some of us know, it's only through their mail order, plus several stores. I went to my local Walmart out in the San Fernando Valley, and they have, I've been there three different times and brought the information, and I keep going back, and they keep saying, well, we're not hearing anything from the home office. So I can't get it at the local store, and my insurance company told me before I signed up for my health plan last year that I could use Walmart mail order. Once I signed up and became a member, they changed their mind.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So I can use Walmart mail order as long as I go into their special 90-day program order that they have, but it's not covering all of my medications because it's not under my insurance. So there are some real issues with that and trying to deal with the local Walmart pharmacies to get them to accept and talk with their home office to get the Script Talk working in the local store.
Okay. Ken, I think if we can set up a call with between you and Scott Grimes of my office next week to get more information, that would be great. And for anyone else, we are going to be having a meeting with Walmart in the next like month or so to talk about whether they're willing to expand the Script Talk program or if they're going to switch to something else. So if you have Walmart or if you want to be able to get your prescriptions through a Walmart store in addition to or instead of mail order, please contact my office because we need that information before we go into this meeting with them.
Okay, to advocate, I'm willing to do that or to go to Rite Aid, whichever you want me to do.
Or both, you know.
Okay, Christy.
Thanks.
Christy will be the last.
Okay. I am a member of Weight Watchers. I have been going through this struggle by myself, so I didn't know what was going on, and I had been asking questions and questions. I would like to be a part of your structured negotiations. I have been working with Weight Watchers for a year, and I am about at goal. And I'm going to be on the maintenance program, but it is pretty difficult. They changed the active link, and I can't use the active link now the way I used to use it, so they made it worse. And I also want to be able to use the tracking system better and to use the... I just got my iPhone, so I have now the smartphone app. But I'm a little bit frustrated because any chance that I had of doing anything was just really not very well dealt with, and so I'd like to get involved with this.
Okay, thanks, Christy. We're no longer in structured negotiations because they did sign a settlement agreement. So they've actually, you know, committed to accessibility. So I'm going to ask Charlotte to give you a call next week to get more details. Is that? Yeah, and you know Charlotte. So, and we'll do what we can to get that straightened out for you.
Okay. Thank you very, very much for being with us today and sharing your time with us.
Yeah. Thank you for having us. It's always a real pleasure and honor to be part of a CCB convention.
Thank you.
And thank you for letting us do all this work on your behalf, because without you, we wouldn't have anything to do.
It is definitely a partnership. Thank you so much. Thank you. And on the, we have a, on our next presentation, we have partnerships
with the San Diego Police Department, Sergeant Jonathan Lowe, Chief Liaison Officer for the Disabled Communities in San Diego, California. And I'm not going to read more about Sergeant Lowe's presentation, because I'd love to bring him on so that all of you can hear what he has to share. Please give him a warm, warm round of applause. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon. You guys have been talking about such important things, and I'm going to bore you with the police department. I tell you, it's a boring life, I tell you. Thank you for letting me come here and speak. I wear a few hats on the police department, so just kind of in the way of introductions and background. I've been with the department for 14 years now. My primary duty is actually as a patrol sergeant. I work in the beaches of San Diego. Poor me, right? Mission Beach, La Jolla, Pacific Beach. I have to spend all day at the beach. So it's rough. It's rough. It's terrible. So that is my actual primary duty. I'm a patrol sergeant. I have 7 officers that work under me, but I have some auxiliary jobs. I'm also one of the SWAT supervisors. I teach at the police academy, and I wear a lot of hats. But one of the best jobs that I get to do is I'm actually the chief's liaison for the disabled communities, and I think that's actually pretty unique. A unique position. There are some departments I know that have community liaisons, whether it's for the African-American community, the Hispanic community, the LGBT community. I don't know many police departments that have a liaison that represents the disabled community. The good thing about my position is that whether it's an issue of dealing with blind individuals, with the deaf, with physical or cognitive disabilities, they have my number, they have my email address, and they can call me 24/7 and contact me with any issues, any problems, any complaints, any compliments that they might have. And I work directly under the Assistant Chief for Community Relations, and I report directly to Chief Lansdowne, which is the head chief here in San Diego City. So I get to do a lot of different things. If you guys know Loretta Moore, she's a volunteer coordinator for the San Diego Center for the Blind. She's actually the head of our board, our advisory board, and she'll call me up if there's an issue. I remember she called me about a blind person who had gotten arrested. And yes, blind people commit crimes, right? I'm looking around the room. I recognize a couple of you, so I won't point you out, though. I won't point you out. Occasionally somebody in a wheelchair will commit a crime, somebody who's blind will commit a crime, and in this particular instance, the service dog ended up going to the shelter, and I know that's not what we normally want to do, and I understand that, so because of the community concern, Loretta called me, asked me about it. And obviously I have access to the police records. I can just call the officer up and say, hey, what was the situation and why did this happen? And it was just those particular circumstances where the dog, that was just the last resort, the dog had to go to the shelter. But I get to mitigate that, and I get to explain why certain things happen. So there's no animosity between the police department and the community, and hopefully the community knows that we're out there looking out for them and trying to do the best that we can. So that's my primary position as the liaison officer. I mentioned the board that we have, the advisory board, and I see one of our board members sitting right up front, Charlene. We have what's called the Chief's Advisory Board, and that's a group of community leaders and representatives from the blind community, the deaf community, you know, again, all sorts of disability groups that meet twice a year with Chief Lansdowne, who's number one, and the assistant chief in charge of the community relations. And it's a unique opportunity where they get to sit down and roundtable with the chief of police and say, hey, chief, this is what's going on in our community. These are the issues we're having. This is what we'd like your officers to know when they're dealing with our community or they're interacting with us or responding to calls. And it's a great opportunity to just sit down with the chief of police and hear it straight from him what we can do. You know, for example, sometimes they'll just say, hey, we get a lot of people around City College not yielding to pedestrians, you know, and we have folks crossing the street constantly. Can we get an extra patrol? It could be as simple as that. Or it can be as complicated as, hey, your policies need to be updated because the ADA just updated their policies. And then that's my job to take care of that. So it's a very unique opportunity to interface with the chief. We just actually had our meeting Wednesday, and we had a rep from the Easter SEALs there. It was his first time there. And he kind of made the comment that, you know, Chief Lansdowne is so serious and so stoic on TV that he didn't expect him to be so funny in person and so personable, which he is. I mean, he's a ball of energy, that guy. So it's a really unique opportunity. So that's part of my position as being the liaison, not only representing you folks and your needs within the city of San Diego, but kind of mediating these meetings with the chief and the community groups. Let me just talk briefly about, everybody's always curious about the training that the officers receive at the academy level and how our officers are trained. So I'll just touch on that really quick. Our police academy in San Diego is a regional academy, and that means all of the various police departments in San Diego County go to the same police academy. Other than CHP, because CHP is a state organization, all the other city police, the deputies, go to a regional academy. It's about 6 months long, 900 hours of instruction for everything, shooting, driving, defensive tactics, you know, law and constitution. So they get 900 hours of training. Of that 900 hours, 11 hours are devoted to disabilities and disability services and interacting with the community. The instructor that teaches that course is actually one of the board members that sits on our chief advisory board. So she's been teaching for a long, long time. She's really well-versed in the community, the different community groups. And so that's just the start. I know 11 hours doesn't seem like a lot, but when you're trying to cram in so much, you know, to a brand new person, teaching them how to be a baby cop, 11 hours is a lot of instruction, let me tell you. But the training doesn't really stop there. What happens is once they graduate from the police academy, they go through what's called phase training, and they have to do at least 4 months of rotations at different stations, different communities, different times, different days off, and different training officers. And then it's really up to the training officers to bring them to the various community groups and organizations that they're going to be servicing for that month. And, for example, I used to be a training officer. I worked in Hillcrest North Park, and so I'd always bring my trainees to Deaf Community Services in Hillcrest and take them up there and say, hey, these are the folks that we're going to be taking care of during this month. You know, you need to be aware of how to interact with somebody who's deaf. What are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to take their police report if they call you for help? You know, how are you supposed to help them? So that's an additional part of the training that our officers get when they're out there. Anytime there's a change in the law, for example, you know, the ADA within the last couple of years redefining service animals, right? And as an organization, as a police department, we get those calls. Businesses will call us, restaurants will call us, or whoever will call us and say, hey, there's somebody bringing an animal in here and we need to know. We want you to kick them out is usually what the call is, right? Or somebody else who's maybe not even the business owner, you know, getting into an argument with somebody who brings their service animal in. And so the officers will go out there and respond. And generally, it's about education. It's about educating the business owners and educating the people who have no clue what they're talking about what your guys' rights are with your animals. So anytime there's a change in the law that affects all of us, I have the ability, and it's my responsibility, I have the ability to rewrite our policies or make additions to the policies, and it gets sent out to the email. It gets sent off to the officers via email, and then every squad lineup or briefing session where they start their shifts in the morning, the supervisor will read those updates and make sure that everybody understands, you know, what we can and cannot do. So that's kind of how the training continues throughout their careers. A couple other ways we've improved and learned is just trial by fire. And I say fire, I didn't realize. I was going to talk about the wildfires, so that was a good pun. You know, in 2003, 2007, we had those major wildfires in San Diego, right? Scary. And that was our first time, that the 2003 Cedar Fire was really our first time doing these mass evacuations and then setting up subsequent mega shelters, right, for everybody who was displaced. And I think for that being our first time, I think we did an okay job. You know, we got most of the people out of there. We took care of them at the shelters a little bit. But we learned a lot from that. There were after-action reports and symposiums that I attended where we talked about, well, when we set up these mega shelters, we brought in porta-potties, but they all had steps to get up to the porta-potty. And what about folks in a wheelchair? You know, they brought in these banks of phones so people could call their loved ones, and yet none of them were TTY capable. Nobody really thought about the fact that, you know, we might have to evacuate folks that are oxygen dependent or their medications have to be refrigerated and we have to set up infirmaries. And so we learned so much just from these disasters and what we can do next time. Hopefully there's no next time, but, you know, next time something like that happens. And the way it affects the police department as well is in the evacuation process. We learned that not everybody watches TV, right? Not everybody can hear the radio. Not everybody knows what's going on. And if we're calling for an evacuation, we really need to go door by door. You know, what if you're dealing with a person who is blind and deaf? How do you communicate with them? How do you tell them that there's an emergency? And because of what came out of those symposiums and the suggestions by our board, you know, we have policies for that. And we've trained our police officers how to be more efficient and be effective when we're talking about those evacuations. Speaking of evacuations, and I think Charlene participated in that statewide drill. Charlene, did you do that, the Golden Phoenix? So in 2010, the police department participated in a statewide disaster drill that was called Operation Golden Phoenix. You may have heard about it. And there were several hospitals that took place, officers of emergency management that participated. And what we did was we filled up the San Diego Center for the Blind with as many volunteers and clients and not just blind folks, but folks in wheelchairs and folks with cognitive disorders and autistic folks. And we filled it. And then we made our officers respond and evacuate everybody and try to, you know, and a lot of these officers have never guided anybody before. And it was a great learning experience to not only in guiding, but loading people onto buses, strapping down wheelchairs in buses, which is what, you know, part of what we're required to do, right? And then once you get to the destination, disembarking everybody and trying to work their way into that mega shelter that they would normally be placed in. So we participated in Golden Phoenix. It was a great learning experience, again, for those officers that participated in, and the firefighters that came in as well. With service animals, I kind of mentioned already, I talked about it a little bit, you know, narrowing that definition for dogs and all the exceptions in the miniature horses and all that. That is something that all of our officers know about. Again, anytime we change policies or laws, all the officers get it via email. They get it in their briefings and in their lineups. And I would say no officer really has an excuse for not knowing what the proper procedures are. And just so you all know, in terms of service animals, if somebody does get arrested or let's say they have to go to the hospital, well, I guess their dog could go with them to the hospital. But if you go to jail, I hope none of you do. But if you go to jail, no, I'm just kidding. If you do end up at, or somebody you know comes with us, to jail, the service animals aren't allowed in jail. And so we will find, it's basically the preference of the owner who we will turn that service animal over to, whether it's the family member, a neighbor, if it's the original agency that trained that animal. We will do everything possible to keep that animal out of the shelter. But sometimes we can't get a hold of anybody or the person is being uncooperative and they just won't provide any information to us, then we have, you know, no other option sometimes but to do the shelter. So again, that's kind of a last resort. But just so you know, we work diligently to take care of those animals. Another thing that was brought to our attention because of the board was folks in wheelchairs. And this is something that I don't think a lot of agencies are doing, and there's agencies out there that are getting sued, obviously, for not doing the right thing. I mentioned before that folks in wheelchairs also commit crimes, right? And we never really had a way to take somebody to jail in a wheelchair. I mean, it seems silly because there's so many transportation companies out there, but a lot of times if the person couldn't transfer, they ended up going to the hospital and maybe just getting a warrant put out for their arrest instead of going to jail. But because of some of the suggestions from our board, I was able to contract with TLC. It's a company in San Diego that works 24/7, and TLC will come out for us. And, of course, the department pays for it to transport anybody who can't transfer out of the wheelchair. The easiest way to take somebody is if they can transfer and it's safe for them to do so health-wise, we'll transfer them to the police car. But we have people that are in motorized wheelchairs, right, that weigh three times more than I do. And those things aren't going in the trunk of my car, right? So those are the occasions when we'll call out TLC. It's very funny. I had a guy who was a habitual shoplifter in a motorized wheelchair because he knew that anytime he got caught, he would just... The officers couldn't do anything because all they could do is write him a ticket and hope that he showed up to court. And I put this policy into place, and about a month into it, he got caught again. And not only did he get caught, but he had like three warrants for previous cases that he's not showing up on because nobody can force him into jail. And he was ever so surprised when the wheelchair van pulled up. You know, if you want equality, then you can go to jail just as equally about anybody else, right? So it works both ways, right? So it was a process, but we got him into jail, and hopefully that will discourage him from shoplifting again. With the electric wheelchairs, and just so you kind of understand, I'm from the San Diego Police Department, and I don't have any... doings with the jail because that's the sheriff's department. But the sheriffs do not accept electric wheelchairs in the jail. They have to transfer somebody to a regular wheelchair, and somebody has to help them be mobile. And what we have to do is we have to get the person to the jail in the wheelchair van, transfer them in the infirmary at jail, and then we have to hold on to their electric wheelchair at the police department for when they get out. And then, of course, he called in a complaint when he got out of jail because he had no way to get to headquarters to get his electric wheelchair. And I had to turn around and say, well, don't shoplift and you won't be in that position. I don't know. You know what I mean? I don't know. I don't mean to make light of it. But, if you don't commit a crime, then you wouldn't be in this position. But, that is another concern. I don't want to leave anybody out on the street because they don't have access to their equipment now. Most canes and walkers and things like that can go to jail. Real basic wheelchairs, or hand-driven or wheelchairs, manual wheelchairs can go if there's not a lot of hiding spots, but the electric wheelchairs, for whatever reason, jail doesn't accept them, and there's nothing I can do about that, but that is just what it is. So... But that equality is it'll come around and bite you, right? If you don't. So, no, but at any rate, those are just some of the examples of what our board has done for the police department in terms of interacting with the community, the education for the officers, and honestly, changing policy within the San Diego Police Department and how our officers interact with folks and. What we can do to have equal access out there. Just kind of a plug for that. If any of you are interested, if you're community leaders in your groups, and you're interested in either participating or just kind of getting more information, I'll leave some of my cards behind, or you can talk to Charlene, because she knows all about it. And or if you just have any issues, you have questions, you want to know, hey, this happened to my cousin's brother's uncle, did the cops do the right thing? I don't know. I can certainly try to answer that stuff for you, and that's why I'm here. Like I said, I think it's a pretty unique system that we have going on with San Diego PD having a liaison. So take advantage of me. Call me 24/7. I don't care. I might not answer. I might call you back if I'm asleep, but I will get back to you. And just understand also that this is within just the city of San Diego. You know, El Cajon, I have no control over Chula Vista, sheriffs, the jail. I don't know. I can't control that. But I might be able to lead you to the right person. But I'm the only disabilities liaison that I know about in the county. So I'll just leave it at that. So I have a couple minutes. So if anybody has any questions.
Hi, Eric Calhoun. I have been in San Diego many, many times here, especially to go visit my aunt, which I'm doing. The biggest question I have with regard to beach patrolling is the act of asking for money and or loitering with the intent to beg. Have you had anyone under any circumstances with regard to people when they try to go purchase an item, they will go ahead and, you know, stand over the person and just constantly hassle them? And what do you guys do about those type of people, especially with someone who's got a disability?
Well, disability or not, I mean, first of all, there's no secret we have a lot of homeless people in San Diego. It's bright, it's sunny, we have great weather, so they take advantage of it too, right? The last count that we had, and I only know this because the chief mentioned it the other day, is we have upwards of 8,000 homeless individuals in San Diego, more than San Francisco, which is like 7,200, but they're all concentrated in San Francisco. With the issue of panhandling and solicitation, if the person is just politely, I'll just use that word loosely, but politely asking for money, and you deny them and they walk away, then there's no crime there. But we do have a statute on the books called aggressive panhandling. And of course aggressive can be a subjective term. But if you are the victim of somebody who is, if you say no and they keep persisting and they follow you, or they, let's say you're at a stoplight and you've got somebody on the median, which is a popular place to be sometimes in San Diego, and they start kicking or hitting the car or spitting on the car, then that's more than just asking for a quarter, right? So there is a aggressive panhandling statute on the book where if somebody calls in, and because it's an infraction or misdemeanor, the victim person has to be willing to place the suspect under citizen's arrest, if that makes sense, and kind of testify on your own behalf, because the police officer didn't witness it. You know, we can't just give somebody a ticket just because you say it happened. You have to be kind of willing to go to court to back it up. So there is that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes.
My microphone. There it is.
There you go.
I wanted to ask you about the issue of pedestrian interactions with cars or potential interactions. That I know I myself have felt sometimes that police officers were, you know, saying, well, you know, you're out of the crosswalk. Sorry, sir. You make crosswalks so I can perceive. I'll stay in them. But I have some of my friends who've actually been involved in accidents say that the police seem to have the attitude that a blind person is automatically at fault. And it's almost like, well, you're blind. You shouldn't be out there by yourself anyway. Do you have a reaction to that?
Yeah, I hope that's not the attitude, and I don't really see that a lot. I mean, if anything, pedestrians usually have the right of way. I mean, granted, I work in Pacific Beach, so don't take it with a grain of salt. I got people dashing across the street every other day. But pedestrians, by and large, have the right-of-way. Whether they have the green light or not, if they're already in the roadway, and I'm not even, forget about being blind or low vision or having an animal with you or a white cane. If you're in the street and you're occupying the lane or you're occupying the crosswalk, cars just can't run you down just because, you know, you're in their way. I would say the default, if there was a collision, the fault usually falls upon the vehicle because they have an obligation because they can kill somebody versus, you know, you might put a dent in their car. However, there are, you know, times where we see people, and I know it wouldn't be you folks, but there are people who just dash across the street or jump out between cars and the car's not expecting it. That's a completely different issue. But any time that, you know, especially those with animals or white canes, you have the right of way, and you know that. And we do have officers, and especially those motorcycle officers, they're vicious, right? So they really do look out for that kind of thing. And I remember when, Charlene, what was it? We had a camp, the white cane safety campaign, and we kind of partnered with that last year, where we put the memo out to all the police officers to, hey, this is White Cane Safety Week or month or day, whatever it was. And we really paid attention to that sort of thing. And we had flyers to pass out to drivers, too. Even just on a normal traffic stop, hey, they just ran a stop sign. We gave them these White Cane flyers as well as a part of the education. Charlene, did you?
Yeah, thank you. What I was going to add is one time in conjunction with the white cane, we were actually in the downtown area and crossing streets and just having a high police presence, allowing motorists to make their mistakes.
Yeah.
Thank you. We have 3 minutes left, so if we could take that last question.
This is Donna Sanchez. I'm not from San Diego.
I'm sorry.
But so am I.
You might be from a good era, I don't know.
But my question is, does your police department have a... when there's an emergency, do you have a place where blind or any handicapped person can go to and say, I am a handicapped person, and if there's an emergency, you need to come and rescue me?
We actually do. Within the county, it's called Ready San Diego, or Ready SD. Where you can self-register. Of course, it's voluntary because not everybody's going to want to register because they think the government's watching them. But that's why some people wear tinfoil on their heads, right? But there is that website where you can register your cell phone information so you get alerts however you want to get alerts, whether it's text, voicemail, email. And you put notes on there saying, you know, if there's a disaster and my area needs to be evacuated, this is how I want to be alerted. And you can type in those whatever special needs you might have, whether it's, you know, I'm in a wheelchair and I'm going to need help driving out of there because I don't have a car. Somebody needs to pick me up. Because that was honestly one of the biggest issues during the wildfire evacuations. We'd come upon folks in wheelchairs, and you know, the officer can only throw you in the back of the car, and hopefully your wheelchair's light enough to put it in the trunk. What we were really educating folks out there about was, in terms of disaster preparedness, it's really on the individual to make sure your neighbors know, you know, make sure your family knows that if there is an evacuation. Hey, somebody lead the fire department to my house, or tell the officers, make sure I'm out, and my two cats, because I love my two cats, right, and my medication. And so we were really kind of putting it back on folks to Make sure you have that good connection in your community with your neighbors, your family, your loved ones. But there is that Ready San Diego website where you can register. Let us know that you're there, and we'll make special arrangements to make ensure that that person got out.
Thank you very much. Everyone join me in thanking Sergeant Lowe. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for being with us today. Yeah. Okay, folks, our general session has ended for today. Hope to see you at committee meetings, President's Dinner, or the session this evening. Thank you.